Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Some years ago, a friend of mine was asked to introduce Henry Kissinger, and he introduced him as a man who needs no introduction. And Dr. Kissinger said, oh, but I'd like an introduction. And I think Gustavo Arellano deserves an introduction. He is a writer, an artist, a critic who has a very original voice and is very sought after. He has become a contributing editor to our magazine, the Journal of Alta California, and is a former editor of the OC Weekly. He has published several books, including Orange County, A Personal History, and Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. Most recently, he's become a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and he's featured regularly on NPR. And his column, Ask a Mexican, was syndicated nationally from 2004 to 2017. He was born in Anaheim, California, to a tomato canner who was an illegal immigrant. His introductory column in the LA Times is going to start last week and is also translated into Spanish, and it will run on Wednesdays. I think we'll just jump in. If I've missed anything from your extensive and very impressive resume.
Handle. Okay. Follow me on Twitter, at Gustavo Arellano.
Sorry. There we go.
No. Do these things now.
Thank you, Dr. Kissinger. Well, I guess I wanted to start with something. When I first picked up your book about Orange County, I discovered in the opening, let's sort of start with origins, that you wrote about your dad in the beginning of the book, and it made me try to imagine what it was like for you as a very young person here. Were you born in America?
Born and raised in Anaheim.
But your dad was an illegal immigrant at the time?
He came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy in 1968. And then the best part of that story, the first English song he ever heard was the Beatles' I've Just Seen a Face. And the only reason I know this was because forever, he would always tell the story about how he came to this country, how he paid a hippie girl from Huntington Beach $25 to sneak him and his cousin across. And he said that there was a song that stuck in his mind, that in his way it would go Tony in San Antonio. And I did not know any song like that at all. I was a big Beatles fan growing up, and one day I buy the Beatles Help album, and I've Just Seen a Face is playing, and the part goes, falling, yes, I am falling. My dad's like, in Spanish, esa es, that one's it, that's the song. So that's my favorite memory of that particular story.
Now, has your dad become an American citizen?
Oh, yeah, thank you, President Reagan. We had a Republican president who realized that amnesty, for undocumented people, could be a wonderful thing, and because of that, my dad became an American citizen. Basically, everyone from his side of the family, they came here across the country illegally. From my mom's side, all my aunts and uncles, they came in as permanent residents because my grandmother was born in a copper town in Arizona that no longer exists called Metcalf, Arizona, close to Morenci, around there.
Okay.
Yeah.
The reason I ask is because the picture I got, and I hope I read it correctly, was that you and your dad began to sort of diverge a little bit in terms of your experience. And your dad is, at least the way I remember the story, has become feeling much more established and feeling like he wants to keep things the way they are, and you're his rebellious son that wants to sort of advance to the next stage of participation in culture.
In many ways, I mean, it's interesting because my dad, he just retired as a truck driver. He was a truck driver for 30 years, short haul around Long Beach, Wilmington, and San Pedro. But he's very much still, both of my parents I would describe as Mexican hillbillies. In Spanish, we would call them paisas, you know, paisanos. Like, you know, their Spanish is quote unquote funny. They're very, you know, they're very traditional and whatnot. So my dad to this day, if he goes out, he wears the Stetson and the nice Stetson too. Like, you know, what, like 100X. X's, or like if anyone here knows what Stetsons are, you know what the X means. Nice, big, huge belt called the Cinto Piteado. It's beautiful, made of leather with the fiber of the agave plant. It's got, mm-hmm. like in an arabesque designs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So growing up, my dad's been like that my entire life. Me, I was born in the United States. I was born in Anaheim. I wanted to wear Chuck Taylors, Doc Martens when I became really rebellious. And just, you know, Pendletons and all that. So my dad always wanted me to be more, everyone wanted me to be more Mexican. And like me growing up, I just wanted to be me. I was proud of being Mexican for sure, but I also kind of liked what I was learning about the culture in the United States.
And I'm curious to ask, so does your dad feel that he's now part of the establishment? He's been here a long time. He's a property owner. He's a substantial person. So
yeah,
in this sort of divide that you portray in your book, which side is your own father on?
It's funny because he's remained sort of in his traditions and culture. He's remained the same. But you have to remember, especially with Mexican migration, it's cyclical and it comes from different areas. So the people of my generation, especially in Anaheim, they came from two states, from the state of Jalisco and the state of Zacatecas. And if you want parallels that sort of in the American mind, Jalisco is Texas. So they think they're all that. They have all that. Jalisco is where the birthplace of mariachi and tequila. So, very romanticized in the American imagination. Zacatecas, we're Iowa. We're like the hardworking, kind of stay quiet, Midwestern types, pretty conservative. That was my generation. But now the newer generation, they're mostly from southern Mexico. They're more urban. And not so much my dad. My dad's a little bit more, he's a little bit more accepting. My mom, God bless her, she's a little bit not accepting.
Yeah.
So she'll say, eso es de Michoacán, which is a state in southern Mexico, more southern Mexico. That's closer to like Appalachia. Like, people think of it as sort of wild terrain. She's like, no, those people from Michoacán, they're bad. Don't trust them. And we, us siblings, were like, why not, Mom? Oh, no, you just can't trust them. I'm like, you're being as racist as people were to you when you came in. Like, it's all the same, ultimately.
Yeah. I remember when you gave that talk at UCLA, you were talking about pochos, who are, as I understood it, people who are accused of having lost their Mexican heritage, but it isn't clear whether they're becoming American or they're just becoming some new form of culture.
Yeah.
and that you sort of hated people being called out or put down because they weren't Mexican enough.
Oh, yeah. No, Octavio Paz, he's the one. I don't know if he specifically used the word pocho, but definitely in Labyrinth of Solitude, he devoted an entire chapter to the Zoot Suit riots that happened in L.A., and he talked about how the children of Mexican immigrants, they were losing their identity, and it was a travesty. So the pocho for decades was viewed as this lesser thing. Yeah, in Selena, like not American enough for the Mexicans, not Mexican enough for the Americans. The movie Selena about the late Tejana singer. For a long time, people viewed that and they viewed it with shame. Around last decade, early last decade, so we're almost talking about 20 years ago, my friend Lalo Alcaraz, the cartoonist for the LA Times, he started trying to reclaim that term as a point of pride,
yes.
Pocho. Now, at this point, I think, especially with the younger people, I can't speak for the younger people, but they're far more comfortable with the fluidity that comes being, and not just like Mexican, but Salvadoran, South American, whatever the identity is, far more so than our generation. Because it boils down to, well, who made the list to say you're Mexican enough? Like, what's the list? Do you have to wear a big hat? Okay. Do you have to drive like a humongous Ford Ranger or like a GMC Yukon to make yourself authentically Mexican? Maybe. But it's silly. It's a silly game. What I always try to tell people, though, is that especially just when I used to do my Ask a Mexican column, this is nothing new. You see the immigration literature from all of America, from the Jews, from the Italians. There was always that question. Our children are losing their touch with the homeland, with the mother culture. And it happened. It always happens.
Yeah. Well, you write about it in very funny ways. And I remember when you were in Los Angeles, you were talking about people stereotypical American speaking some form of Spanish is easy to detect.
Yeah.
But you were talking about subtler way that people use accent, or they mix words in, and that there's sort of a gradation of how authentic you are.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, with Americans, there was a play written about my life in Denver, of course. Denver, God knows what kind of city it is that they want to do a play about me. But they had a whole segment about something that I wrote about specifically about how sometimes white folks, they try to prove that they know their Mexican stuff by putting ñes on top of everything. So habanero, the chili habanero, it's a good word. All of a sudden, it's habanero. Or what was another one? Like, I can't remember some of the other stuff, but people, it's interesting because sometimes people try to prove like, yeah, we're down with the Mexicans, but then at the same time, you're really not down with the Mexicans. You're just trying to prove yourself culturally, or especially with food. Oh yeah, I could go to Taco Bell and I could order the entire menu without a single accent. Now I'm smooth. I could order enchiladas and say it perfectly. Enchiladas.
That was what you were saying, and it made me laugh then too. One more question on this area, but you have written sometimes, I take it as sarcastically, about Chicano studies departments.
Yeah.
And yet you've been a teacher in these departments. So what's your take? What's that all about?
Chicano studies is important. First and foremost, it's American history. And I always find it funny, people who freak out about ethnic studies being made a mandate in high schools to graduate. Oh my God, it's subversive. It's going to teach our children not to be American. It's all American history. It's just history that has never been written into the grander American narrative. Or when we were written into the American narrative, to put it into the California context, you know, when you had a Bancroft writing about all the California families, they were losers. You know, the gay old dons of the past, and they were just part of a land, and they just were never able to develop the land. That's how stereotypes build up. You never really talk about some of the heroes or some of the other people who have done that. So I always made fun of Chicano studies, though, specifically in my Ask a Mexican column, which was always satirical. I made fun of everyone.
Yes,
but recently for the LA Times, I wrote, like, I taught Chicano studies at Cal State Fullerton for a couple of years, and I think it's a very interesting discipline in the sense that it teaches you really what academia is supposed to be about, which is question everything. You know, it's a journalist thing. If your mom tells you she loves you, go check it out. So when it comes to Chicano studies, it's the same thing. Like, you always want to question. You shouldn't just accept things at face value. I would always tell people, you know, don't believe what I have to say. Question me as well.
Yeah.
I think that's a healthy thing.
Let's switch to food for a minute.
Yeah.
Take a break from politics. It seems to me you have certainly made a brand for yourself in talking about street food and truck food. And can you talk about that a little bit? Why does that inspire you so much? Because your palate is very sophisticated. And I've always wondered, what would happen if somebody sent you to the French Laundry? I think we'd get a great
review.
Let's do it.
Fly me out there. I want to go to the French Laundry. Yeah, let's go. It's funny what people think about me or how they know me and how little really they know about me. So obviously, nationally, I'm known for writing about Mexican food, Taco USA. I love that book. I will get mileage out of that forever. But I was a food critic for the OC Weekly for 16 years. And for six of those years, I did both a column about Hole in the Walls, but I also did the high-end restaurant. So I called everything that's coming out of Orange County, Taco Maria and Alta. We said that Taco Maria is the most important restaurant, period, in California right now. So I could do the high and the low. But specifically about Mexican food, the reason I started getting associated with it was because of my book. And the only reason I wrote my book was because I realized that no one had ever done a full-fledged history of Mexican food in the United States.
True.
As a reporter, I go for stories that no one has told. I didn't do it so much because I was Mexican or because it allowed me to eat Mexican food across the United States for 2 years, which was a job of a lifetime. I want to do a sequel, damn
it. You created that job.
In a way I did. And when I did that book, and this was 2012, this is already 6 years ago. So whenever I would lecture, I would tell people, I wrote the first draft. Everyone else, please continue my work. Go do those oral histories. Go do those regional histories. And I'm glad to say there's a lot of people now doing a lot of important stuff on Mexican food specifically.
Yeah. And there's now a high-end Mexican food. We wrote something about the sort of new Baja wine country.
The Alta Baja, yeah.
But when I picked up your, what I think of as your taco book, the opening chapter is about NASA and about serving tacos in space.
Burritos.
Yeah. So if you haven't read that book, you're in for a treat. It seems like fast food is also one of your pet peeves and pet loves. And, you know, is that... there's fast food that you like, and there's fast food that you don't like.
I think the Del Taco bean and cheese burrito for $1.08 is perfection. It is just, people like it. People know what I'm talking about. It's just simple and to the point. On the other hand, the Jack in the Box tacos, two tacos for 99 cents, they're disgusting, but I can't stop eating them. They are a guilty pleasure, bar none. On the I think when it comes to fast food, we have to be honest. There's going to be some people that do good stuff. There's going to be some people that don't do other good, or they don't do good stuff. You have Taco Bell. Everyone likes to hate on Taco Bell. I hate on Taco Bell. I hate on Taco Bell because I don't like their food. I think they put too
you
much salt in it.
Made it very hard for me to ever eat there again.
Eat at Del Taco. There's Del Tacos in the Bay Area, right?
Okay.
You have to eat there.
Well, I won't give away the plot, but I know that in an upcoming issue, you're writing about In-N-Out, and
I will not give away your review.
But you also seem to really like other kinds of food, like Mediterranean food, and you had that book. I'm thinking of a title in one of your books about that there should be a Mexican restaurant next to every
taco trucks at every mosque.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what's that?
So that's part of the essay that I wrote for Alta for this issue about the changing Orange County. And it's a movement that started in Orange County by two friends of mine. One of them is a school teacher in Santa Ana of Mexican heritage. And another one is a Muslim woman of Palestinian descent. And they were friends. And one day, you know, this is after the election of Trump. There was that notorious comment about a Mexican
yes.
immigrant saying that if you allow too many Mexicans, then there's going to be taco trucks at every corner. So especially in Orange County.
I thought that was a good idea.
I think it's a wonderful idea. No one complained. In Orange County, the two most despised minorities are Mexicans and Muslims. So they decided, why don't we just make America's nightmare happen? And let's get a taco truck at a mosque. And you do cross-cultural unity, but at the same time, you serve great food. So it's funny because at the taco trucks at every mosque, the inaugural event happened at the Islamic Center of Orange County, the oldest mosque in Orange County. And so there were some alt-right protesters who went to troll them. But then they realized there's tacos here. Even the alt-right likes tacos. So they lined up and they ate their tacos and there was no incident whatsoever. So tacos can change lives. They really can change society. It's incremental, but I think we should allow for that possibility.
I see. Okay. Well, that explains it. And I guess I asked you, but I would love to see you do some high-end restaurants.
Let's do it.
I think you have a wonderful palate. You write about food with great knowledge and love, and I like food critics, and Michael Bauer writes for the magazine occasionally now.
Yeah.
He's not with the Chronicle, but I've listened to him talk about how he approaches doing a food review, and it seems very similar. You have a different idiom, you speak in a different voice, but
yeah.
your attention to detail is very similar to what the high-end critics look for.
I go as just someone who likes food. I don't try to frou-frou it up. I don't try to go fancy. Is the food good or the food's not good? I'm not an elitist, and I'm also not someone who romanticizes street food. So I'm not going to say, I've never been to French Laundry, so I'm not going to talk about, I'm not going to say anything about it, but I'm not going to say after I had it, the French Laundry is amazing, I'll say it's better than a lonchera. It's better than a taco truck. I'm not going to be one of those people that
if it is though
and I talked about this in my review about Taco Maria. They serve $16 tacos, and most people say like, no way would I ever spend $16 on two tacos. And I tell them, eat the taco. After you eat it, you will realize not only is it worth $16, it's worth $100, and it's the best taco you'll ever have, especially the arrachera one, which is kind of like carne asada, but that's what they call it up in northern Mexico.
Okay. Well, let's switch a little bit to journalism. I mean, you're a very clear, easy, you write quickly, and yet, the work has great craft. How
Thank
did you.
You
get interested in journalism? Were you interested as a lot of writers start out knowing in youth that that's what they wanted to do?
No. Growing up, I had no idea what I wanted to do, except I knew that it had to involve reading. I didn't get into journalism until I was... It was the spring of my junior year at Chapman University in Orange. So I had just turned 21, and I found a fake issue of the OC Weekly, like the real fake news. It was an April Fool's issue in the mode of the Onion, the famous totally fake news. And I thought it was a hilarious issue. They had an article called Five Latinos We Really Like, that the only Latino on this story was a Taco Bell Chihuahua dog. I knew people were going to be offended, but I also knew that people were not going to get that this was supposed to be satire, like Mad Magazine, like The Onion. So I wrote a fake angry letter to the editor. The editor, the founding editor of OC Weekly, Will Swaim, another Will, he saw something in me that I didn't realize existed. And he said, you should write for us. And I told him, well, I'm not a writer. At the time, I was a film major, film studies major, actually,
okay,
at Chapman. And long story short, he saw in me that I was someone who thirsted to tell stories.
Yes.
And people ask me, where'd you get your training? And I'm honest when I say this, by reading Sports Illustrated. When I had a teacher in junior high and eighth grade, her husband subscribed to Sports Illustrated. You know, I was a poor Mexican kid. My family couldn't afford any subscriptions. So she would give me, after he would finish his issue, she would give me the issue. And Sports Illustrated, especially back then, amazing writers. Yeah. Rick Riley, Leigh Montville, everything. Like, yeah, stories about old, like about the Jack Johnson fight against...
especially the last story of Sports Illustrated.
Exactly.
It was almost always...
Amazing stuff. And it's just a great craft of writing. So I really think that was my journalism
school. No kidding. That's very interesting. Well, it seems like journalism is going through a lot of changes. And you've lived through it yourself because, you know, you were kind of either going to have to do layoffs and you decided not to do that. But what is ailing journalism as you see it?
I don't think that the owners pay attention to the reporters. The reporters know what sells. The reporters are talking to these advertisers, but because there's that separation of church and state, they do not allow that. Like, when it came to the OC Weekly, I was the editor there for almost 6 years. I'd been with the paper for about 16 years. It was the only job I ever had as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I went to the owner. He said, we're not making the money we're supposed to. So I told him, let me go sell ads. I will sell ads. Let me be the publisher. If I don't make the marks that you want me to in 6 months, then fire me. But I guarantee to you that I could sell because I know who are the people who want to advertise with us. But no, there's that separation, and I get it. I don't think the money should influence the editorial. I would never allow that. But that's that. And the other thing, of course, you have to be flexible in how you tell the stories. I still believe in the printed word. That's why I love Alta so much. But that said, there's a place for podcasts.
Yeah, sure.
There's a place for video. There's a place for a Twitter account or whatnot. But at the same time, also, people just want great stories.
Yeah.
You should not succumb to the cult of clickbait. You have to stand for something that's actually great.
Yeah, I thoroughly agree.
Yay, applause. Absolutely.
It's. I have to think about what you're saying because, you know, when I was editor of one of the newspapers here in town, I would often say to the editors, look at what the advertisers are really interested in. Not to give something to the advertisers, but these are business people.
Yeah.
And they're making these products because they think people are interested in skiing or interested in vacations or, you know, so that is a clue as to what topics our readers are interested in. Those people are spending money to try and reach that audience. So I think there's been the church and state thing has gotten carried to a sort of an absurd degree.
Yeah, you can definitely still keep your editorial standards, but
absolutely,
at the same time, like one of the big advertisers for OC Weekly to this day is High Time Wine Cellar, legendary liquor store in Costa Mesa in Orange County, and they absolutely loved us. They loved everything that we covered, but they also loved that we had a column called Drink of the Week. And every time we talk about a cocktail, we talk about like a bottle of bourbon or gin or whatever, and it's like, I'm not selling out who we are just because I happen to be writing about something that one of our advertisers carry. Booze is big, especially in Orange County. You have a big craft cocktail scene, so why shouldn't we be writing about these things?
Yeah.
And more than anything, you don't want to be in the ivory tower. Another example, really quickly, MMA fighting. I can't stand it. I'm a boxing fan. My boxing career lasted one match. But that said, was I going to let my biases that I don't like MMA get in the way of us not covering MMA? No, we covered MMA all the time to the point where the MMA, the gyms and the promotions are like, okay, this paper is starting to cover what we like. Maybe we should start advertising with them. You just have to be smart about it.
Yeah, I agree. I tell a story sometimes. I remember when I was a publisher, we were running a story about a bank that was in trouble. And I got a call from the bank president. He said, you know, if you keep running these stories, you're going to harm this bank, and there's going to be a lot of jobs lost. And I said to him, well, I'm sure you're right, but we're actually publishing the paper for the depositors, not for the bank owner. So if
that's
this bank is in trouble, you know, that's where our obligation lies. So if you think it through, you can solve those problems.
Mm-hmm.
Then it seems to me, Gustavo, that you got into some sort of a controversy because of not being politically correct, or you were accused of, maybe not for, but weren't you doing a blog or doing something? You were in charge
of them all? I mean, I It's
how did you get into that situation?
Which situation in general? Honestly, like on Twitter recently,
you took over something and you published one or two tweets. And then a whole bunch of people started to respond and say, this guy is homophobic.
Oh, remezcla. Yeah. So
this happens occasionally to you?
No, it happens all the time to me. You know, there's a Latino website called Remezcla. Really good stuff. I like what they do. When I left the OC Weekly, I got in conversations with them to be an editor at large. My whole job, I was going to do like two or three stories a week, but also try to bring in new voices, especially voices from the West Coast, because they're based on the East Coast. So I started writing for them like in October. I got announced as editor at large, like let's just say January the 5th. I lost that job by January the 7th. There was a whole Twitter campaign, boycott Gustavo Arellano was a hashtag. I was accused of being, homophobic, anti-Central American, anti-woman, anti-black, anti-logic, I don't know, a whole laundry list of things. So Remezcla, at first, they were going to stand by me, but then the protesters started calling the advertisers. So at that point, they got rid of me. And they still wanted me to write, but I'm like, no, I'm not going to write for you. If you're not going to stand by these tweets, and if you really believe all these things, even though I have a whole career behind me, like, frankly, I don't want to write for you at all. It was a very surreal experience. I'm going to save my full thoughts for my own newsletter at the end of the year. All I'll say is that the boycott Gustavo Arellano campaign was the best thing that ever happened to me. And let's just leave it at that for right now.
It's like being banned in Boston.
Basically.
Arts and culture was something I wanted to talk to you about, because I remember when... at one of your talks, you started talking about bands that you liked. And I remember I was in the audience and I was trying to find the band and download the music while you were talking. But you seem to have a lot of interest in film and books and music. So let me ask the question this way. What about picks and pans, movies or music that you love and things that drive you crazy?
Oh, my God. Everything. I'm more of an old music type of person. So, I mean, Bach, the Brandenburg Concerto is one of my all-time favorite anything. I think it's just a masterpiece. But the Beatles were my favorite band of all time. Down in Southern California, I'm old, so I still listen to radio. I don't have Sirius or Pandora or Spotify or whatever. There's a station in Southern California called La Mera Mera, like the Mighty Mighty, basically. And they play rancheras, like music 60, 70 years from Mexico. From Mexico's golden era of Mexican cinema. So I've been listening to that a lot, but then I'll switch over to classic rock, Lynyrd Skynyrd and all that other crap. Good music is good music. When it comes to music, film, I don't know. My favorite director is Stanley Kubrick. Then my second favorite's Billy Wilder. Then my third favorite's Tarantino.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of everything. Wilder, I mean, Kubrick, because he was just a genius. But what I loved about Wilder was just he was such a cynic of the human condition. He would have been a great reporter.
Yeah. And he had quite a range.
I mean, oh, my God. Yeah. Slapstick. The Apartment is just a masterpiece. Yeah. Ace in the Hole with Kirk Douglas. Very underrated actor, too.
I had a chance to meet him one time. He was absolutely exactly what you'd expect.
Huh.
Funny, irascible. You know, the pictures on his wall, you'd think, like, is that who I think it is? Yes, that's who it is.
Yeah.
Let's see. We've got some questions coming up, and please send them up. But let me ask you a couple of other things that I've come across in your writing. One is you occasionally write about the difference between Hispanics versus Latinos. What distinction drives you crazy?
That'll never
end. What does that
mean? It doesn't drive me crazy. I actually like the fact that you can't define us. So if you want to, you have to go macro into micro. So if you want to say what a Hispanic is anyone who can claim heritage from the Iberian Peninsula. So Spain, Portugal, the Portuguese always try to differentiate themselves from Spain for the obvious reasons. And then all of what is now Latin America, that would be classified as a Hispanic. Then a Latino would be someone from Latin America. From, you know, what constitutes Latin America? Okay. Latin America, of course, a construction of mostly the English, if anyone. Then you want to go more specific. You go to your national identity. So Costa Rican, Mexican, Argentinian. Then, of course, I always try to talk more about Mexican identity. So then you go Chicano. A Chicano would be a Mexican American, but if you call yourself a Chicano, usually you're putting a political value to your identity, this idea that if I'm proud of my Mexican-American heritage, but because of that, I'm going to be a little bit more politically involved in my community, whether through art, whether through community organizing and whatnot. Yeah, but identity is always evolving. There's a new term, Latinx. Latinx means kind of think of Latino, except in Spanish, it's a gendered language, so you have Latino for males, Latina for females, so the X is meant to imply that, you know, it's genderless. And so that's really interesting. I've gotten in trouble by talking about that. But what I like, though, is that people call themselves what they feel they want to call themselves. And I think that's a very powerful thing. You know, people always say, well, why don't you call yourself American? It's like, duh, we're all American. We know that. But why do we have to identify ourselves as such? If anything, that betrays an insecurity on your part that you're worried that we're not calling ourselves American.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
You also wrote in one of your, something I read of yours, about something you called chipsters going into Boyle Heights. And this is kind of gentrification in the community. And, you know, back to this theme of, it seems like the community in Orange County, we'll get to Orange County in a second, you made me see it as like layers, people that came here when and where they came from, and you even have a younger generation that's now opening art galleries, and, you know, they bear heritage, but they are leading and creating cultural norms that are now only in America.
Yeah, so I wrote two articles about it for the LA Times for my column, but the bigger idea is it's about gentrification. Of course, gentrification is happening all over urban areas in the United States. It's been happening in San Francisco here for decades, especially in the Mission District. It's been interesting.
Yes.
I've been traveling to San Francisco now once a year for 15 years now. It's been kind of heartbreaking to see how the Mission has changed from like being this iconic barrio to getting more and more hipsters, at least in the San Francisco area. In Los Angeles, that's also happening in Boyle Heights and Santana, but the main gentrifiers are Mexican Americans themselves. And a lot of these people, they say what they're practicing is gentrification. Gente meaning people. And this idea of gentrification is that people who grew up in the barrio, they went off, got their education, became professionals, and now they're coming back and they want to reconstruct. They want to reconstruct a romanticized image, a romanticized neighborhood that they remember in their past, but with wine bars, but with cool barbers, something that falls upon them. But they say it's okay that we're doing it because we're from the neighborhood. We love the neighborhood. We're never going to destroy the Latinidad of the neighborhood. I think it's an interesting argument, but it's basically brown washing gentrification. It's as I call it, it's gentrification with a happy face.
Okay. Another comment of yours that stopped me in my tracks was that you consider Americans the people who stole California from Mexico.
Well, yeah, of course. No, we know that. That's nothing new. The American Southwest was stolen from Mexico. Ulysses S. Grant said something to the extent there was never a more unfair war that the United States waged. Who was a president? I think it was Polk. It was all about stealing California. It's a miracle, frankly, that they didn't go down. No, I think the reason they didn't go after all of Mexico and just take it completely was because they didn't want any miscegenation, which is completely hilarious. If you go down to Southern California or here in the Bay Area, everyone ends up being Mexican one way or another. So who won? Who really won and who really lost?
Okay. I think we should try some questions. Or are there questions?
We got a question right here. But yeah, write some questions. That's the way we're doing this.
We missed the California Journal. Will we cover Sacramento? Yes, on the one hand. But one of the things I'm trying to do is to try and consider, you know, whether there's a really Western perspective, and I define the West as kind of west of the Rockies, west of the 100th Meridian, including parts of Canada and parts of Mexico, the West.
Yeah.
Dry, arid, mountainous. And I guess I grew up on the East Coast, and I was interested in publications like The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books because I thought they covered arts and culture with a great emphasis. And this is part of human life. I was a mathematics student in school and a technologist by profession, even though I worked a lot in business. So I kind of felt like technology is being covered, business is being covered, politics is being overcovered. Why would a magazine try to cover politics when it's changing every 40 minutes? Why would a quarterly ever be able to do that? But arts and culture last longer and affects people in just as profound a way. So I wanted to see if we could find a Western voice. And I looked at Mark Twain and Ambrose Bierce, and that's where our board of inspiration comes from on the magazine. So we'll cover Sacramento, but not because we're so interested in California, but because we're interested in things that happen in the West that are emblematic to the people that live here.
Yeah, you had an interview with Jerry Brown's wife, Anne.
Yeah,
that was good. Like anything, and you interviewed Kamala, anything that's really going to speak to the Alta voice, that's what I feel Alta will cover. You don't want to cover the top. You don't want to cover what everyone else is covering. You want to tell the stories that are big. You want to call stories before they happen.
I was joking with the staff, and I said, we cover the past and the future, but not the present.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Because we're interested in how things got this way and how they might be different. But how they are right now, well, there's a lot of other people doing that.
Yeah.
Okay, so this, I think, is for you. Do you cook, and do you cook dinner for your family? Do you like to cook?
I only know how to cook quesadillas and the perfect egg over easy. I am completely biased. I have the two greatest cooks in the world in my life, my mom and my wife. I was also a food critic for 16 years, so I was eating out 4 or 5 times a week. Like it was there was no reason for me to cook at home. I also, going back to writing as, sort of my philosophy on food writing, I always wanted to do it as a consumer, not someone who knew the magic behind it. I wanted to guess the magic behind it. I don't want to know that, you have cloves here and it takes 3 sprigs of rosemary for that. No, I want to taste it. Does it taste good? Yeah. Does it taste bad? Can I decipher it that way?
Yeah. I agree with you. I guess we shouldn't, this question reminds me to sort of delve into a whole topic where you've become quite an expert, which is Orange County itself.
Yeah.
And I remember when I saw you speak before, you talked about even then how Orange County was changing and that if you were telling young people today, if you want to find a place that is the way Orange County used to be, you should go to the Inland Empire, you should go to Riverside, Orange County's finished.
The old Orange County, the old evil, nasty Orange County.
But can you talk about that? Because I know you've written about it. I'm not sure what question to ask you.
Yeah, no, I'll talk a little bit about the essay that I wrote for this issue of Alta. So I wrote a long essay just about where Orange County is, who we were, because a lot of the national and even international media has descended on Orange County this year because there's a good chance that Orange County, the land Reagan said all the good Republicans go to die, might not have a single Republican congressman, which is completely like mind blown, absolutely insane. So people are coming in. You're having these dispatches. Everyone's coming, the New Yorker, the New York Times. Last week, I did an interview with the Swiss version of NPR. Tomorrow, I'm going to meet with a correspondent for El País, the biggest newspaper in Spain. And they're all coming in and they come with this like, oh, wow, Orange County is really changed. And I tell people, you guys haven't been paying attention. You're still relying on stereotypes from the Real Housewives of Orange County.
Yeah.
And I say this as someone who, again, born and raised in Anaheim. I've never lived outside of Orange County in my life. I covered Orange County professionally since 2001 as a reporter for OC Weekly, then the editor. And so my essay really dives into it. How has Orange County changed? For one, we've been majority minority since 2004. So white people have made up the minority since then. At this point, I'd be surprised if they even get to 40% of the population. I also talk about how some things have not changed. So one of the big issues has, the old Orange County has roared back, or the city of Los Alamitos, under a Japanese-American mayor, they sued the state of California over the sanctuary state policy. Homelessness, of course, has been a huge, huge issue in Orange County. You basically had a homeless encampment along the Santa Ana River. If those of you who know from Southern California, have ever been in Southern California, when you pass the Orange Crush, which is where the 5, the 57, and the 22 freeway meet, right down from Angel Stadium, there was a homeless encampment there of over 1,000 people. It was an open sore in Orange County, and I loved it because it was an embarrassment. It showed the world, the Orange County, the image that we try to make ourselves out to be, it's not real. It's absolutely fake. So the Board of Supervisors had to shamefully try to fix it. They tried to put a temporary homeless shelter at the Great Park, the old El Toro Marine Base. Well, what happens after that? You had 2,000 Chinese immigrants get on buses, get transported to the Orange County Board of Supervisors offices and start protesting. So the line that I had, leave it to Orange County to make immigrants into frothing white supremacists. Like nothing. Oh, it was some of the nastiest rhetoric I've ever seen in my time in Orange County. And I used to cover neo-Nazi groups for a living. And here's these middle-class Chinese immigrants in Irvine saying, we don't deserve homeless people. We're good people. The racist implications in that is absolutely disgusting. But that old that's the last gasp of Orange County, and I am just so happy that it's dying, that old Orange County.
I think one thing I realized when I looked at the map is how big Orange County is. You see it as these sort of like, you know, Robert Dornan and his neighbors, but it's a vast area. It goes damn near to San Diego and right up into almost the city of Los Angeles.
It's 3.3 million people. It's one of the biggest metropolitan areas in the United States. And then a lot, you know, and then the Orange County influence, though, is spreading nationwide. I didn't really get into it in here, but basically, the whole you could draw a through line between Orange County and its hatred of Mexican immigrants all the way to the White House with Donald Trump. Like, you know, we created 187, which passed in 1994, that became the template for SB 1070 in Arizona, other laws in Alabama, and that whole rhetoric was just grabbed by Donald Trump and you know, and he ran with it right into the White House.
It's funny because the last place he could sell it is the modern Orange County.
Oh, yeah. He came to Orange County twice. One time he showed up to the Pacific Amphitheater, which is where the Orange County Fairgrounds is. It holds a maximum of around 9,000 people. He claimed 35,000 people showed up, which was complete lies. And then he showed up again to the Anaheim Convention Center. Not as many people. He came to California earlier this year. He didn't dare stop in Orange County.
Yeah.
It's not his ground anymore. No. Orange County voted for Hillary Clinton. It was the first time since 1936 that Orange County had gone Democrat in a presidential election. Amazing.
Yeah, I see it even at a distance because when I lived in Los Angeles, I remember being assigned to Orange County, if you were in a major newspaper, was kind of like Siberia or, you know, the police beat of a remote place. Nobody wanted to go.
No.
And now I see the new Los Angeles Times is moving because that's really where the action is, if you want to cover what's happening in the basin.
I really feel like Moses at the mountaintop. I cannot cover Orange County on a regular basis anymore because I have the whole state of California to cover now.
Yeah.
And right when I left my position, that's when everyone starts going into Orange County. So in a way, I feel vindicated, though, because at the OC Weekly, we always just bang the drum and saying, hey, everyone, pay attention. There's interesting things happening in Orange County. We had a monopoly on it for many, many years, and now people are flooding in. Their stories are still wrong, but at least they're coming in and trying it. So that makes me happy.
Are there demographic changes beyond, you know, white and non-white? Are there other ethnicities that are coming in? You mentioned Chinese and you mentioned different groups that are now sort of recharging the population base.
Yeah, I mean, we have the largest Vietnamese population in the world outside of Vietnam in Little Saigon. We have huge communities of Middle Eastern, Persian, Eastern, right. Turkish, all completely different groups, you know, and also Indians and Pakistanis, which under the census are classified as white, but huge, huge groups. We have one of the largest population of Syrians in the United States outside of the Dearborn area. What we still don't have, though, is African Americans. Out of the 25 biggest metropolitan areas in the United States, we're the only metropolitan area with an African-American community of less than 5%, and we clock in at 2.1%. And anytime you bring that up, though, people accuse me of being racist. Like, why do you have to say that there's very few black people? Black people don't belong here. They don't want to live here. They want to live like, oh, gosh, the stuff that they say, the excuses that they make. We know why African-Americans don't live in Orange County, because it has a historical reputation for being racist as hell. We had the largest Klan rally in the 1920s. We had a Klan rally at Anaheim at Pearson Park, which is a beautiful little park, of 30,000 people. It was the largest Klan rally ever held west of the Mississippi. Of course, African Americans don't want to be subject to that.
Hmm. Sounds like there'd be some good real estate opportunities.
It's a golden land.
Any more questions? Has somebody got a question that we haven't had a chance to?
We got one
cover?
More. Don't be shy, folks.
Okay. All right. Do you have another? This question is: do you have another book underway?
I have many ideas for books. I wanted to do a book about the truck driving industry. because my dad was a truck driver. The truck driving industry is going through a huge change right now with automated trucking. This whole country runs on truck drivers, whether they're the big rigs or the U-Haul drivers, even to the little Ford Ecoline vans or whatever. My agent said, that's a great idea, but you have to do an article about it because none of the book publishers in Manhattan have ever seen a big rig go down Broadway. and of course, what ends up happening, this is like 2 years ago, I didn't have the time to do an article. Now there's all these articles coming out about trucking. There's been trucking books, so I can't do that anymore. But I have another one. The problem with me, there's a book that I want to write, and then there's a book that should sell. And I get it. My agent wants to make money for the both of us. So I need to think of a book that sells. And I hope, I just got an idea, and I hope, I'm not going to say it right now, but I hope that that book is definitely something I want to write, and I think it could sell. I just need to, you just need to sell it to, package it in the proper, proposal for these New York publishing companies.
What about a movie or a screenplay? You seem like you...
You know what's funny? I actually sold a screenplay to ABC about gentrification in Boyle Heights.
Yeah.
It was about 2 years ago. They passed on it, which I get it. They said the characters weren't developed enough. Hey, it was my first time trying to do a screenplay since I was in college. That were, you know, it didn't work out. Then I had another idea about it was going to be a sitcom about a Mexican American couple opening up a Mexican restaurant in the South. And I've seen it. I've seen Mexican families come from California, go out to the South, and establish restaurant dynasties there. And I basically got orphaned. The guy, the executive who liked me at Fox, ended up going somewhere else, and then they put me with another executive. I wasn't one of his projects, so it went nowhere. It happens.
Everybody's working on their own deal.
Exactly.
And the people I know that have a screenplay in them or are interested in are pitching Netflix and doing it as a serial.
Yeah.
Getting a screenplay picked up by Warner Brothers seems very
antiquated.
2010.
I like journalism though. I gotta say you the visual world is perfect. It's wonderful. Like, it's very influential. But I just like journalism. I like to do long-form stories. I like to do essays. I like to do breaking news. I like stuff that has immediate impact. Yeah. Recently, the United States government announced the arrest of four white supremacists who played a role in the Charlottesville attack from last year. Those were people who beat up my reporter at the OC Weekly earlier in 2017. Frontline did a documentary about them. They got the names of those people from the work that we did. That's the type of stuff that I like. Yeah. You want to do stuff that's immediate and it's going to have quick impact.
Cool. This is a question about, do you have any favorite food spots in the Bay Area?
El Castito makes the best burrito in the world. on the one off of Mission around 16th or so, it's like that 1970s yellow and red with a rook outside. El Castito. The little castle, like the Rook, El Castillito, and then I hate to say this, but every time I'm in the Bay Area, that's where I eat. I just go there, I get my burrito. I can't say I've been to many other places in the Bay Area. You folks got to tell me.
This is a question about writers that you like or writers that you admire.
Oh boy, where to start? I think the two best writers about California are Mark Erics and Sam Quiñones. Both of them used to be with the LA Times. Mark covers the Central Valley like no other. And then Sam is the best writer ever about Mexican migration to the United States. Just amazing. Like I always tell people, when I grow up, I want to be those guys. They're absolutely amazing. Jill Lepore at the New Yorker just writes amazing articles about American history and then American tendencies as well. You have Jill Lepore. You have a friend of mine. He writes. He publishes a website down in L.A. Daniel Hernandez called L.A. Taco, and it's mostly about tacos. But it's also especially in the wake of the demise of L.A. Weekly, that's really stepped up as a voice of covering the underground. And I write for them as well. But Daniel, just an amazing writer. Used to write for the L.A. Times for a long time. Then was with Vice for a long time.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting how the quote-unquote underground press has also had the same problems as the above-ground press.
What happened was that the alternative weeklies, our ethos became mainstream.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no more relevancy for these alt-weeklies anymore. Their only advantage is that they do local journalism. And so they have to stick to that local journalism. They can't be bothered anymore with trying to cuss as much as possible. Yeah. It's like, go with what you know. Yeah. And if you have that, you might have a chance at that. But if you don't, then best of luck.
I agree with you. It always was amazing to me that when newspapers got into trouble, you know, they would never cut the sports section, even though everybody knows the scores.
Yeah, nowadays especially.
But they would cut the book section, even though the only people who are reading are readers.
Yeah. Go figure.
Go figure. The other thing I always noticed about the underground press is typically no business section, no sports section. They would cover City Hall, but from a more sort of pointed point of view. But they really covered local drama, local theater, local. So there was an arts and culture dimension. I always thought, like, boy, and they have much younger readers.
Oh, yeah.
Demographic. I always thought, like, why don't mainstream newspapers go overboard on covering culture and arts? And still, the cover City Hall.
But
trying to be a website on paper is a bad idea.
It's interesting because even though I never had any ambitions of being a reporter, I was subscribing to both the Los Angeles Times and the Orange County Register since I was like 11 or 12 years old. So I have one of those photographic memories, so I remember almost everything. I remember stories, I remember bylines, and they used to have, they would do really good at covering arts and culture, but it was still the rarefied stuff. It wasn't the subcultures. It wasn't the stuff that the young people did.
Yeah,
so
right.
They did a lot of good stories. The LA Times especially had a really good arts and culture section. They still really do, but you're still not getting the stories that are really resonating, not just with the young people. I wouldn't say it's always about a cult of youth either. It's about getting stories that are really good. Like, for instance, at the OC Weekly, I commissioned a story. It was a Mexican group that they did stoner corridos. Not narco corridos. So these were not corridos praising like El Chapo Guzman or like these narco lords, but just praising the stoner lifestyle.
Yeah.
And they had the accordion, they had the tuba. It's like spliffing up. And I don't smoke marijuana, so I apologize for my really bad lingo. But the daily papers would never cover that. Never mind that they're selling out the Nokia Theater, that they're blowing up. Like, but we got that because, well, one of my interns was a stoner, 23-year-old stoner, Mexican. He's like, hey, boss, like, there's this really cool group. What is it? Yeah, they do stoner corridos. And I heard it. I started laughing like, oh, my God, this is funny. Do it. Go for it.
Yeah. Well, that's, I was an admirer of Jan Wenner, who built a long-term success just covering, you know, rock music. So it always seems culture was something that the mainstream press was sort of allergic to, particular pop culture. And the other thing is when I can remember in a newspaper, if a young person came to a traditional newspaper and said, I'd like to write for you, the traditional answer was, well, that's great, but why don't you go to, you know, the Daily Bugle of El Cajon.
Bozeman, Montana,
right,
or something.
And prove your chops, whereas I think in other situations, you know, getting young people, and you can spot talent relatively quickly, like the person who found you.
Yeah.
And you read their clips and you go, great, come here.
You know,
and Jan was always very good at hiring people. And then sometimes people would come to him and they'd say, I just got an offer for a $200,000 screenplay and I need a raise. And Jan would say, congratulations, that's wonderful. And I said, how does that make you feel? Because you've lost this person that you developed before anyone believed in that person. You gave them a chance and they came through. And now they're kind of leaving you behind. He said, I don't worry about it. I'll go get another one.
Exactly. There's always talent there. And
exactly.
I don't even think,
you know, in baseball,
clips,
it would be understood that you go get younger people.
No clause rule, Kurt Flood.
But in media, there's always been this kind of prejudice for experience over talent.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Will there ever be a Latino governor of California?
Ooh, that's a good one. There has to be someone who can capture the mainstream magic. Villaraigosa would have had it if he had not done his Villaraigosa things. I mean, that's the most polite way of putting it, but he had it. He really had it, and he destroyed himself. Javier Becerra, I love him. I think he's great. I think he's perfect, though, as Attorney General. I don't think he'll ever run for governor. Kevin De Leon, I mean, he could have had a chance if he didn't go after Dianne Feinstein. Now he just totally antagonized the powers that be at the Democratic Party.
Right.
So we'll see what happens with that, but I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to need someone who we probably don't know about right now, young rising talent. Alex Padilla, I don't think has it. I think he's too blah. You need that charisma. Look at Gavin. You know, Gavin has that charisma. Jerry Brown was Jerry Brown. Schwarzenegger. The last uncharismatic person was Gray Davis, and we're not going to have that anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. This is a question about the military presence in Orange County and Southern California.
Hmm.
How big a factor is, the Marines and those big bases as part of the sort of Orange County cultural Matrix.
It used to be huge. I mean, we had El Toro, we had the La Salle. The National Guard is still based out of there. You still, you know, in Inland Empire, you still have March Air Force Base or whatever. But and then, of course, Long Beach, the Navy was there right up until the 90s. But everything shut down. The only real, I mean, you still have a lot of veterans there. And you have the Navy, the Veterans Hospital in Long Beach, right next to Orange County. And then you have Pendleton, which is part of San Diego County. Mm-hmm. But really, the Pendleton influence only goes up to San Clemente, which, you know, all the way down there in South County. So the military doesn't really have the influence that it used to have anymore.
That's right. Pendleton is not in Orange County.
No, it's no. Everyone thinks it is, but
yeah,
no.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
It used to be part of one of the old ranches, though, of James.
Irvine Ranch or something.
No, it was Don Juan Forster. You know, one of those great California names, Don Juan Forster, Rancho Santa Margarita, and then some other thing. And that's what's now the current Rancho, basically what's currently now South County. That's not the Irvine Ranch. And then spilled all the way down to Pendleton.
Wow.
It was the O'Neill family was the last people who owned the Pendleton base, or the Pendleton area before World War II.
This is a question about diversity in newsrooms and what could be done to attract more Latino talent into these newsrooms.
Don't fire them. I mean, the sad thing is Latino, writers of color are now increasingly the young reporters, and, you know, they're going to colleges and they're getting hired and they're getting paid nothing. But then when it comes to layoffs, they always fire the young ones, period. So you need programs that can convince people of color that there is a viable future in the news industry. And when I talk about viable, I'm not talking about whether news is going to exist. News is always going to exist. Right. But is there a place where they could actually make a living out of it? Especially in these stratified times in California, you can no longer just intern for free. You can no longer just, here, we'll pay you $100 for a story. You got to pay these young people a living wage. Yeah. I mean, and the problem is that they're coming in and you have all these veteran reporters, what we talked about earlier about experience. Yeah. You have all these veteran reporters who, we could count on them for a story, but they're taking stuff away. It's kind of like housing, actually. Yeah. Get rid of the baby boomers. Go away. Give it all to the young people.
I worked on a project that the Hearst Company did to get more women into some of our businesses. And so there was a group of young women, and everybody sort of had, maybe I shouldn't generalize, but there was a traditional, what I would call the Mitt Romney view, that we've got these binders of women, and we're going to make them all, we're going to recruit women, we're on a program. And what came out of the people who were working there was, you know, there's sort of a hidden network of women talking to women that saying, this is a good place to work. You know, it won't be held against you that you're a woman. They have a good pregnancy leave policy. There's a lot of subtle little things that cue people. And I'm wondering, when you're trying to attract Latino talent or any kind of young talent, you know, what's the hidden message?
It's not just
the offer and kind of like, hey, welcome here. You can sit on the Latino desk.
Yeah.
We've just
you
formed.
Be the token. Yeah. You be that token, you be that
but there
token,
has to
you
be
that
something
token.
That's sort of woven into the structure.
I think it has to be structural. So like at the OC Weekly, when I started, I was the only writer of color. I was not just a token Mexican. I was a token Vietnamese. I was a token Muslim. I was a token everything, because none of the other writers were really covering that. But by the time I left OC Weekly, we're almost 50-50. Yeah. And it was all my hiring. And for me, it wasn't affirmative action on my part. I just wanted to hire people that reflected the Orange County that I knew.
Yeah.
And so it happened to be people of color. But I also hired, you know, young white folks as well, young women as well as whatever. The gender was also 50-50 as well. It's just like, can you tell me great stories? Can you tell me stories that I've never heard before? And it so happens that a lot of them was people of color. Like, and, you know, like when I talk about this to journalism schools or to classes, I tell them, like, I'd rather take a young white woman from Eastern Kentucky who's the first person in their family to graduate from college than a middle-class African-American woman whose family, like, has been in colleges for generations, because I'm sorry, that, you know, girl from Eastern Kentucky is probably going to have better stories, all because of class, though, not because of race, but because of class. Like, okay, you're coming now into the big city. Talk to us.
Right.
Like, what's going on with that?
What do you see? Carrie Beecham wrote about the early days of the film business and how there were a lot of women screenwriters.
Oh, yeah.
And the point that she made in her talk was, well, the theory then was that the motion picture business wasn't going anywhere. So let the women have these jobs of writing screen. And then when it became a more established industry, they kind of pushed the women out. And her, and so the point that she was trying to make is these sort of struggles for equality are not won. And then it's over. Congratulations, you're equal now. But there's this perpetual sort of stress between majority culture and other culture. And you have to sort of keep the fight going and keep the oxygen being pumped into the system, or it will decay back to the way it was.
You have to know what's going on with the waves in mainstream society. You have to know what's going on. What's the street talking about? What is the street now? It's not the street of your youth.
No.
I'm 39 years old. I'm not necessarily old, but I'm not necessarily young anymore. But if I think the whole world should be the way I experience it, then my newspaper is not going to go very far, and my career is not going to go any far. On the other hand, I have to always be looking out. It's like, what do you tell your reporters? Okay, what's next? You're only as good as your last story. What's next? What's next?
That's very true.
It's true.
Okay. Last question. So I guess we've reached the point in the program where there is time for only one last question. And this one would be, do you think that there will ever be another president from California?
There has to be. We're California, for crying out loud. We are the great land, the great hope for the rest of the United States. It's not going to be Garcetti, I can say that much. It's not going to be Kamala as well. Like, she's, I like her and I don't like her because she supported Tony Rakakis, the Orange County District Attorney, who's totally corrupt and just bad. So I can never forgive her for that. But
you know too much.
I know photographic memory again, way too much. Jerry Brown would have been a great president. He's just I've always been a fan of his, but of course he's not going to run. I think he wants to go back up to Colusa. That's what he's saying. I'm going up to Colusa.
I believe him. I think he's really reached a stage in life where he just wants. You know, I think he'll be, but you know, normally somebody in that stage of life would be recruited to go on corporate boards and, you know, go make some money. And Jerry really does have that sort of Jesuitical streak.
I love
where
it.
He's just not that interested. You know, he'd be a very hard person to bribe because he's not very interested in money.
No, I think in your interview, Anne was talking about, like, you have to tell him to buy a new jacket.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
He's had it for 7 years or whatever.
She gave him a sweater for
That's
Christmas.
That's what it was, yeah.
And he said, oh, honey, I already have a sweater. And she said, well, now you have two.
Yeah.
You could wear a different one from time to time. But that's rare in politics.
Yeah.
Most people have a much more obvious
of course.
Self-aggrandizement motivation. I guess the last question is the one we always ask, which is, in your future, what do you look to do next? What are your sort of bucket list projects next in line?
I have never had goals. I look for stories. That's it. I mean, I'm ready to write more great stories for Alta. I'm ready to write more columns for the Los Angeles Times and just for any publications that want me to write for them. But like, I'm not going to say, oh, well, I want to write another book. I do want to write another book, but like, you know, I just feel things come, things go, so you just have to hop on those opportunities when you have them. But also, as a reporter, you can never rest on your laurels. Again, you're only as good as your last story. You always have to be going again and again and again. I'm lucky. I'm blessed. I mean, at this point, you know, going back to the young reporters, I don't have to apply for a job to be an education reporter in Daily City or something, you know? I can basically go to a publication and say, hey, I have these developed relationships and say, hey, I want to write about this. Can I write about it for you? And most likely that publication is going to say, sure, or maybe not this story, but like do that story. So I'm really lucky in that sense.
That's a good plan. I remember the cartoonist that Scott Adams that did Dilbert was talking about how goals suck was his basic thesis.
He sucks, but that's a whole other story.
Well, okay, all right, but he wrote this book about, you know, how to seek success, and he said the trouble is if you have a goal and you haven't reached it, then you have this experience of I haven't reached my goal.
Yeah.
So he sat next to a guy on an airplane who said, I don't have goals. The minute I get a job, I'm trying to get a better job.
Hmm.
So I'm always achieving. I'm always busy on my project. I'm never short of my goal because my goal is finding a better job.
Yeah.
And that's
what
I'm working on. And that's kind of what you're saying. You know, your goal is to find another story.
Yeah.
It's not to get to some status or win a prize.
Oh, no, no. I mean, I'm also a very, very loyal person. So if there's a publication that I like, I'd rather write for them than write for other publications. I'll give you an example. I'm not going to mention the publication, but I was writing for a pretty prestigious publication this year. And, you know, after a while, they really didn't like my stories, even though I knew they were great, great stories. So then I started publishing for another big publication, and they loved all my stories. So I, even though they pay less and they're less prestigious than the other one, I figured I'd rather write for you folks because I think you folks need more attention, and I know my stories are great stories, and lo and behold, the stories that I write for them, they become conversation pieces. They go national. Yeah. They go viral. So, you know, if does that cost me maybe prestige? Maybe, but I guess ultimately my goal is just let me do the things that I want to do.
Yeah.
Simple, or as I always tell...
And then you're always doing it.
Yeah, or as I always tell... I think my boss, I would just tell him, just let me do my thing. You like me? You say you like me? Okay, let me do my thing. If you don't let me do my thing, then you don't like me. Then what the hell do you
Why
have
am
me
I
here
doing
for?
It? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're very proud to have you in Ultimate
Magazine. I love it.
And I'm Will Hurst, the publisher. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you know and where you're in the know, is hereby adjourned. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, fun.